You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, really a lecture cycle, and in addition, another small one called Human Life in a Cosmic Context. This is the complete volume, Collected Works, number 175, recorded for the first time. This is lecture 14, translated by Simon Blaxland de Lange, given in Berlin on the 19th of April, 1917. Julian, called the apostate or renegade, and one of Constantine's successors, who in the year 363 was assassinated during a campaign against the Persians, was one of the greatest figures in world history. In Julian the Apostate, we have before us an individual who occupies a very special place in the history of the West. For he was a person who demonstrated how opposing forces need to be at work if world evolution is to be able to unfold in the appropriate way. We saw in Constantine a personality who needed, in a certain sense, to terminate the old ruling principle of the Roman emperors, which had applied to the majority of them, namely that they were granted access as of right to the secrets of the mysteries. Instead, Constantine did everything he could to endow Christianity with an exoteric status, as I indicated yesterday. Even from his very earliest childhood, Julian was viewed in the worst possible light by the imperial family and those associated with them. At the time of which we are speaking, the birth of such an individual was preceded by all sorts of prophecies and predictions. His family had been led to believe, as a result of various Sibylline prophecies, that he would grow to oppose the impulse that had lived in Constantine. And from the very outset, they tried to prevent Julian from becoming emperor. Efforts were made to have him killed. All manner of preparations were made to have him murdered along with his brother. There was a kind of aura around Julian which inspired terror in those around him. It is apparent from the stories that gathered around the figure of Julian that he was viewed by those who had the attitude indicated as having something uncanny about him. When he was taking part in a military campaign in Galilee, when he was still a young man, a somnambulist cried out as the army passed by, quote, "There is the one who will restore the old gods and their images," close quote. Thus, there is something deeply meaningful, something spiritually determined about the appearance of Julian. As very often happens in such cases, he was allowed to live for fear that an even greater disaster might ensue from his murder than from his life being spared. People talked themselves into believing that any initiatives that he might take to counteract the policies inaugurated by Constantine could be frozen in their tracks and speedily aborted, and every possible precaution was taken to render ineffectual the tendencies arising from Julian's particular disposition. The primary aim was to give him a thoroughly Christian upbringing in accordance with the orientation of the ideas of Constantine. However, this had little effect on him and met with complete resistance on his part. And wherever he was able to apprehend anything deriving from ancient Hellenic traditions, his soul was fired with enthusiasm. Because where powerful forces are at work, they will ultimately win through. It so happened that as a result of the very efforts that were made to keep him away from dangerous places, he was driven into the hands of all sorts of Hellenic tutors, became familiar with Hellenism and with the traditions of Hellenism. And then, when he grew older and had learned how the work of the Neoplatonic philosophers was imbued with the spirit of Hellenism and ancient Greek culture, it eventually came about that he was initiated into the mysteries of Eleusis. Thus, after the principle of initiation had already been erased from the sphere of influence of the Roman emperors, Julian embodied this principle as an initiate on the imperial throne when he eventually came to occupy it. Everything that Julian did, and what history has, it has to be said, been at such pains to distort in every respect, must be viewed utterly in the light of the Eleusinian mysteries. And one can only rightly evaluate a figure such as Julian if one is prepared to take the effects of this initiation very seriously. What, after all, did Julian derive, in terms of soul development, from having undergone initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries? He had learned through direct inner perception the essential truths of cosmic and world evolution. He had learned about the spiritual origin of the world, and how these primal spiritual forces find expression in the planetary and solar systems. He had learned to understand certain things which were completely beyond the comprehension of his contemporaries, with the exception of a few Greek initiates, and specifically the relationship of the influence and essential being of the sun, S-U-N, to the ancient logos referred to by Hermes. This was something that lived strongly in his soul. He had, in a certain sense, understood the meaning of the words of Pythagoras, quote, "You shall never speak against the sun," close quote, by which, of course, he does not mean the outer physical sun, but that spirit which is concealed behind the sun. Thus he had come to know that it is in harmony with ancient sacred traditions to ascribe the spiritual foundations of the world to the sole spiritual essence underlying the sun, and to see that it is of primary importance for man to form a relationship to it if he wants to arrive at the source of his existence. So, you need to be aware that Julian had an inner experience of the whole of the ancient sun mystery, of the truth that this physical sun, which appears before our physical eyes, is merely the outward aspect of a spiritual sun, which can be reawakened in the human soul through initiation. And once it has been awakened, it can reveal to the soul the intimate connection between the expanses of the cosmos and the historical life of man. It was made clear to Julian that nothing can ever be instituted here on earth that emanates purely from human reason and is bound up with the human brain, that only someone who is able to conduct a dialogue with the sun logos has any right to have a say in the way that the institutions of the world are organized. For he was obliged to recognize a common law in the movement of the heavenly bodies, and in what takes place here on the earth amongst human beings, in the great historical movements of mankind. Even a church father such as St. Chrysostom was fully aware of the existence of an ancient sun mystery, a spiritual sun mystery, since he went so far as to declare that the outward physical sun dazzles human beings on the earth to the point where they are unable to perceive the spiritual sun. But if one beholds everything that lived in the surroundings of a man like St. Chrysostom, in whose soul a ray of the wisdom of ancient times continued to shine, one can see that there was barely more than a last vestige of understanding for that method of awakening the soul to the secrets of the universe as they had been communicated through the old mysteries, and as they were indeed communicated to Julian the Apostate, who was one of the last to be a recipient of them. The situation was therefore that Julian the Apostate was completely surrounded by adherents of Constantine, by those who thought entirely as Constantine did. It is true that every now and then in the period until the end of the 9th century, a few outstanding figures appeared in the West, also among the popes, who continued to be inspired by the old mysteries. But the impulse that emanated from Rome was aimed at nullifying the efforts of such individuals, and a quite definite policy was pursued toward the traditions of the old mysteries, which I shall speak briefly about shortly. Julian was indeed utterly surrounded by a thoroughly exoteric form of Christianity. Through complicated processes that are difficult to describe in their full psychological details, he arrived at the idea of envisaging how it would be if he were to utilize the last vestiges of the old initiation that had come down to him, in order to bring about their continuing development in human evolution. I must emphasize that Julian was far from being an opponent of Christianity. He was simply committed to the continuing development of Hellenism. One sees him for what he really was, if one understands him more as an advocate of Hellenism than as an opponent of Christianity. For all the fiery enthusiasm and energy at his command was devoted to the cause of preventing Hellenism from dying out, from being eradicated, and to furthering its ongoing development, so that a legacy might be bequeathed to subsequent generations. He was opposed to an abrupt break in continuity, to any sudden change. He was indeed a personality of considerable stature. Since he had been initiated in the Eleusinian mysteries, he knew that the kind of things that he wanted to achieve would not be feasible unless one were closely linked with the spiritual forces that are at work in the sense-perceptible world. He knew that if one seeks to introduce impulses into world evolution, merely out of what lives in the physical world of the senses, and in outer historical events, one is, as Pythagoras put it, quote, speaking against the sun, close quote. He did not want this, and indeed he wanted the opposite. He actually took up one of the greatest challenges that it is possible to imagine. Now we must not forget that there was already active opposition in Rome to such a campaign, as indeed there was in the entire south of Europe. Do not forget that up to the century of Constantine, last remnants of ancient spiritual rituals continued to exist in their abundance among broad sections of the population. Indeed, the whole question of miracles represents a particular problem, a real burden for those seeking to interpret the Gospels today, because there is a great reluctance to read the Gospels out of the background of the time when they were written. For the contemporaries of the evangelists, the miracles did not present any problem whatsoever, for everyone knew perfectly well that there were rituals where forces were derived from the spiritual world which people were able to control. While Christianity was being introduced in an outward political sense, a process that culminated in the deed accomplished by Constantine, a similar degree of energy was devoted to suppressing the old spiritual rituals. One law after another was enacted in Rome, with the object of ensuring that no rituals should be celebrated which derived forces from the spiritual world. This was outwardly presented as an attempt to stamp out old superstitions. It was declared that no one should engage in ritualistic ceremonies in order to cause harm to anyone. No one was allowed to communicate with the dead, and so forth. Such laws were brought into force. But behind these laws was the endeavor to eradicate every last trace of such spiritual realities as had remained from ancient times. It is true that history tries, wherever possible, to hush up or conceal what was really going on. But our modern scientific approach to history, which claims to be, quote, unprejudiced and not subject to any kind of authority, close quote, does not take into account that the initial attempts at writing historical accounts and records were undertaken in monasteries by priests and monks. And there was in such places an absolute commitment to obliterating the true character of antiquity and to preventing anything of significance from being passed on to the future. And so, Julian saw the vanishing world of antiquity in a completely different light from those who preceded Constantine. And he knew from his initiation that the human soul has a connection with the spiritual world. Of that he was sure. He could only hope to succeed in the task that he had undertaken, to use the forces of the ancient principles of initiation to contribute to a continuing process of development in human evolution, by in a certain sense counteracting that trend in evolution which dominated the world in which he lived. And indeed, Julian's initiation had led him to become a man with a very deep love of truth, with a sense for truth that people such as the Emperor Constantine had not even the slightest inkling. It can indeed be said that the serious respect for truth that emanated from Julian has barely any parallel in the subsequent history of the West. With his profound sense for truth engendered through his initiation, he assessed what was going on in the schools and institutions for higher learning of his day. Since Constantine, Christian dogma had been introduced into schools in the form in which it had been disseminated by that time. On the basis of this Christian dogma, the teachers gave their interpretations of the old Hellenistic writers, those authors whose works included significant elements about the gods of antiquity, Zeus, Apollo, Pallas Athena, Aphrodite, Hermes, Mercury, and so on. The idea now arose in Julian's mind, quote, what do these teachers think they are doing? Are they not the most mendacious sophists imaginable? How can they presume to expound ancient writings whose whole foundation is that those who wrote them had the inner feeling that the gods are living forces in the world? Can such teachers, who because of their dogmas must necessarily deny in the most fundamental way the very existence of the gods, presume to be able to interpret such writers? Close quote. Julian's instinct for truth was outraged. He, therefore, forbade all those who, on account of their Christian dogmas, were inherently unable to believe in the ancient gods from giving interpretations of the Hellenistic writers in the schools. If one were to proceed today in accordance with the same honesty of purpose as Julian displayed, one may well imagine the extent of what would not any longer be taught in our schools. But you need to be aware of the deep sense for truth that did indeed reside in Julian. Julian wanted to be equal to the challenges of his time, which were from another point of view nonetheless very necessary. He was thoroughly aware of the Gospels, which had arisen in a completely different way from what had been imparted to him through the Eleusinian mysteries. He could not reconcile himself to the way that the Gospels had arisen. He said to himself, quote, if what has derived from Christ is a principle of initiation, it must be possible to discover it in the mysteries, for it would have to be able to live in the depths of the mysteries. Close quote. He also wanted to ascertain whether it would be possible to continue the ancient mystery teachings, What he knew of Christianity was initially only what it had become in his time. He wanted to make a great experiment, and to do so over a particular issue, though not the sort of experiment that reckons only with human issues, which he would have considered childish. He wanted to perform a deed that would have significance for events in the spiritual world itself. He therefore said to himself, quote, The Christians prophesied that the temple in Jerusalem will be destroyed, so that no one stone will rest upon another. Close quote. This, continue quote, he said, has happened. But Christianity will not come to fulfillment if this prophecy were to be discredited, if it were to be countered by something else. Close quote. He then resolved, with great capital expenditure, to rebuild the temple at Jerusalem in accordance with the conditions at that time. And it indeed came about that a number of workmen gathered together in order to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Now this whole affair must be regarded from a spiritual viewpoint, for Julian wanted to challenge not only human beings, but also the gods. And it is an undoubted fact that can even be proved historically, insofar as historical facts can be outwardly demonstrated, for from an inner point of view it is absolutely certain that each of the workmen who had started to rebuild the temple had a vision of tongues of flame flaring over the place where he was working, and they all had to withdraw. The enterprise was abandoned. Nevertheless, you can see the scale of Julian's ideas. After this scheme had failed, after this grandiose attempt before the whole world to discredit the prophecy of the destruction of the temple has come to nothing, Julian sought to achieve his object in another way, and what he now attempted was no less ambitious. The time had not yet come for evolutionary developments in Europe to be affected by that wave of change which owed its origin to the fact that one of the greatest teachers of the Church, Augustine, was unable to raise his sights to a certain idea because he lacked the spiritual maturity necessary to do so. You probably know from your historical studies that Augustine, and I have spoken about this on various occasions, among others when discussing the legend of Faust, had originally been an adherent of Manichaeism, that teaching which had arisen in Persia and claimed to be able to understand Christ Jesus better than Rome and Constantinople. This Manichaean doctrine, whose ultimate secrets it is unfortunately not yet possible to speak about today, even in our circles, filtered through in a variety of ways, and also in later times, into the West, and had, in a somewhat degenerate form, more or less disappeared from view by the time that the Faust legend was first written down in the 16th century. Through an intuition of genius, the revival of the Faust legend by Goethe was also in a certain sense a revival of Manichaeism. Julian thought in broad perspectives. He had ideas that embraced humanity as a whole. In a person such as Julian, it becomes especially clear how insignificant ordinary human thoughts actually are. Thus the doctrine of the, in quotes, Son of Man had to take on its various forms, depending on people's capacity to form ideas about man, about the essential being of man. It was, of course, inevitable that the ideas that were formed about the Son of Man depended on people's conception of man, for the one follows from the other. People differed very widely in this respect, very, very widely, and we have at present only a very slight understanding of such matters. In Sanskrit, the word for man is manushya. This word expresses the basic feeling that a large number of people associated with the idea of humanity. What is one referring to if one gives man the name manushya, thus if one uses this word stem to designate man. One is referring to the spiritual aspect of man. One is evaluating man, above all, as a spiritual being. If we wish to express the idea that man is spirit and his physical aspect is only the expression, the revelation of the spirit, if that is we are attaching a primary value to man as spirit, we use the word manushya. In accordance with what was said earlier, one can study man from another angle by focusing one's attention particularly upon the soul. One will then pay less attention to the fact that man is spirit and focus more upon man as soul, while the outward physical aspect and everything associated with it will remain more in the background. One will then characterize a person primarily from the way that his inner qualities are manifested in his eyes and from the erect gesture of his head. If one examines the derivation of the Greek word anthropos, one finds that this is what it means. Hence, those who characterize man with the word manushya, or with a word with a similar sounding root, are viewing man primarily in terms of the spirit that descends from the spiritual world, while those who characterize him with a word that sounds like the Greek word anthropos, and this applies especially to the Greeks themselves, are giving expression to man's soul nature. There is, however, also a third possibility. It is possible that one concentrates mainly upon the outward earthly aspect of man, the bodily nature that is engendered by physical means. One will then characterize man with a word that essentially refers to a procreating being, or to what has been procreated. If one considers the derivation of the word homo, one finds something of what has been described. Thus we have a quite remarkable threefold conception of man. But you will be able to discern from this threefold picture that a person like Julian, who knew something about these matters, was very understandably guided by an instinct to search for a spiritual interpretation of the Son of Man. The thoughts arose in his mind, quote, "You have been initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries. Is it perhaps possible for you to force your way into the Persian mysteries? And to have yourself initiated into the mysteries lying behind the teachings of the Manichaeans? You may perhaps gain from there the possibility of furthering the continuing development which is your aim." Close quote. This was a momentous idea. But just as the campaign of Alexander had more to it than the purely trivial purpose of making conquests in Asia, so was there more involved here than the conquest of Persia. For he wanted to see whether the Persian mysteries could enable him to make further progress with his objective. The best way for us to understand what is involved here is to ask, what was it about Manichaeism that Augustine did not comprehend? As I have said, this does not involve speaking about the ultimate aims of Manichaeism, but it is possible to give a few indications. In his youth, Augustine was greatly preoccupied with Manichaean teachings. They made a considerable impression upon him. He then exchanged the teachings of Manichaeism for Roman Catholicism. What did he not understand about Manichaeism? What was it that was beyond his grasp? The Manichaeans did not develop abstract concepts. They did not develop the sort of concepts that separate thoughts from the rest of reality. To foster ideas of this nature was impossible in Manichaean terms, as it was for initiates of the Eleusinian mysteries. I have tried to indicate the difference between purely logical ideas and those with some bearing on reality. The basic principle of Manichaeism was to cultivate ideas that are not simply logical, but are grounded in reality. Not that unreal ideas do not also have a part to play in life. They do, unfortunately, play a big part, especially in our time. But the part that they play is also what you might expect. And so one of the features of Manichaean teaching is to form ideas which are not mere thoughts, but which are powerful enough to take hold of the outer world of nature and to play an active part in that world. The sort of idea that was fairly widely formed about Christ Jesus at that time would have been inconceivable from the Manichaean point of view. So what was the commonly held picture of Christ Jesus? The somewhat nebulous idea had arisen of Christ having incarnated in Jesus, and that through him something had occurred in earthly evolution. These ideas became very obscure, especially in the 19th century. If, however, one were to ask whether what is ascribed to Christ and his potential influence in Christian dogma can really lead to something, if one asks insistently, honestly, and sincerely, it is impossible to answer in the affirmative. For if human ideas are not powerful enough to envisage an earth that is not the grave of humanity, but one that enables mankind to undergo a transformation, if one does not have the capacity to think of earthly evolution other than how modern scientists describe it, which is to the effect that the earth will cease to support life and the human race will become extinct, no idea about Christ Jesus will be of the slightest help. For even if he has had a certain influence upon the earth, the conception that is generally formed of this is not powerful enough to raise matter to the point where it can be envisaged as being capable of being transmuted from its present earthly condition to a future state. Far more powerful ideas are needed than have hitherto been formed in order that the earth may be embraced through such ideas and translated to a new existence. I recently said in the course of a public lecture that natural science thinks, or rather calculates, that if the forces of nature, as they are today, were to persist for millions of years, a state of affairs would arise, I described this to you in connection with a lecture before the Royal Institution, where one will be able to paint walls with albumen and read the newspaper in phosphorescent light. I also referred to the scientist who claims that in the distant future, milk will be solid and emit a blue light, and so forth. These ideas arise from nebulous conceptions of reality which are not powerful enough to lay hold of reality. For this obsession that science has with calculations is equivalent to studying the changes in the human stomach over 4 years and then reckoning what it will be like after 250 years. The idea being that if I simply extend the number of years, I will know how things will be. In the same way that the scientist calculates what the earth will be like in a million years, so can I work out what the condition of a person's stomach will be like after 250 years. Only the person concerned will be dead by then. Just as geologists calculate how the earth looked millions of years ago, so could one calculate on the basis of the changes in a child's inner organs in a week or in a fortnight's time their condition 250 years ago, when, of course, the child was not yet alive. These concepts are not capable of fathoming the full reality of the situation. They have a limited validity, encompassing the millennia surrounding our time, extending roughly from 6,000 to 7,000 BC to AD 6,000 to 7,000, but not any further. However, man's being cannot be limited to such narrow timescales, and the Christ being has an essential place in such a wider evolutionary framework. It was for this reason that I said that there is a difference between what was referred to in the Middle Ages as a mystical wedding and what Christian Rosenkreutz called the chemical wedding. The mystical wedding is only an inner process. As many theosophists have previously said, and perhaps still say now, if one looks deeply into one's inner being, one finds an identity with the divinity. This was depicted in such graphic colors that those who had heard one of these hour-long lectures left with the conviction that if they zealously pursued an inner quest, they would feel as if they were themselves some kind of god. The chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, on the other hand, conceives of these forces as being active within man in such a way that they take hold of the whole of his being, so that when matter has been reduced to ashes, it is able to make the transition to the ages of Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. An important aspect of Manichaeism was the conquest of evil, the victory over matter through thought. The challenge to understand the question of the fall, of evil in general, and in association with them, the question of Christ Jesus at a deeper level, was what confronted Julian, and he hoped to derive some illumination regarding these questions from his Persian initiation, which he could then bring back to Europe. It can also be verified historically that he was assassinated by an adherent of Constantine, or rather of the Christians who adhered to his policies. Thus you see that the principle of maintaining some kind of continuity was, I would say, tragically led into a blind alley through the premature death of Julian the Apostate. As a result, the Augustinian principle, that ideas that are in accordance with the Manichaean principle of uniting material conceptions with a spiritual thinking should be forbidden, became the generally accepted view. The West was, therefore, driven toward a process of abstraction, which, with a certain inevitability, permeated the whole of Western Europe. Only certain significant individuals rebelled against this tendency. One of these was Goethe, whose whole way of thinking led him to do so, whereas one of those whose thinking was most fully in tune with this abstract idea was Kant. If you open up his title Critique of Pure Reason, and I am well aware that I am saying something thoroughly heretical here, but it is true nonetheless, and read its main propositions, and then transform each one of his propositions into its opposite, you will arrive at the truth. This is especially the case with his most important statements enshrined in his theory of space and time. One can methodically transform every proposition into its opposite and say no where he says yes, and yes where he says no, and you more or less arrive at something that is tenable in the spiritual worlds. You can gather from this why people have such an incentive to misrepresent Goethe, the great antithesis to Kant, in the way that this was done by the person I told you about recently, who put words into his mouth that mean the opposite of what he wanted to say. Quote, "No created spirit teaches nature's inner heart," close quote. If we bear all this in mind, we shall also be able to appreciate the full value of what Julian wrote, which was directed specifically against Pauline Christianity. It is a remarkable document, not so much because of what it contains, but because of its similarity to much that was published in the 19th century. This may seem paradoxical, but the fact of the matter is that if you read Julian the Apostate's polemic against Christianity, you find that all conceivable arguments are advanced against Christianity, against the historical Jesus, and against certain Christian dogmas, and with an intense sincerity of feeling. Not with a false emotionalism, but with utter sincerity, with a strong inner conviction. And if we compare these arguments with what liberal theologians of the 19th century and their successors and people like Drews and those people who, on the basis of this liberal historical research, have denied the historical existence of Christ Jesus, if we consider what is presented in all the relevant literature, which had its origins in the 18th century, and then leads in the 19th century to the most meticulous, painstaking, and thorough philological studies imaginable, and there are a great number of repetitions so that one has to consult whole libraries, we find that we can draw together certain guiding principles. Many of the criticisms had their origin in the discovery that a comparative study of the Gospels reveals discrepancies of one kind or another. I have often spoken about this, and there is no need to repeat myself here. But if we make a list of these guiding principles and statements, we can find all of them already expressed in what Julian writes. Nothing really new was said in the 19th century. It had already been said by Julian the Apostate. Moreover, he expressed it with a certain creative originality, whereas in the 19th century it was stated with enormous industry and great theological erudition, and with an equal degree of theological sophistry. Julian the Apostate had therefore taken on a battle of titanic proportions. His ultimate aim was to achieve continuity in the development of the mysteries by giving a fresh impetus to Manichaeism. Just imagine what it would have meant for really enlightened people such as Goethe, who had an instinctive urge to bring the spirit of ancient Greece to life within his own being, if Julian the Apostate had been successful in his aims. There was, however, quite another reason why there was an inevitability about the fact that he failed. But one will not understand his failure if one is insensitive to his greatness, if one is blind to his stature as a titanic figure who fought for a human understanding of cosmic relationships that can really penetrate earthly realities. In our present time, it is particularly important to recall such great impulses in the historical evolution of the West. For we are living at a time from which we will not emerge in a healthy way if we do not consider the aims of someone of the magnitude of Julian the Apostate in a fresh light. It was not possible at his time, and this was his great tragedy, to reconcile the old principle of initiation with the deepest essence of Christianity. In our time, this has become possible, and we must make use of this opportunity to translate it into reality if the earth is not to enter an evolutionary decline and mankind is not to enter a downward cycle of development. We need to envisage the importance of regeneration in all spheres of life. And it is especially crucial to restore communication with the spiritual world. We must, to begin with, form a clear picture of what is trying to frustrate these aims. People today are afraid of clarity of this nature. They dread such penetrating insights. Although there is plenty of physical courage in our time, there is a conspicuous absence of intellectual courage. This is what, above all, is lacking. There is a real unwillingness to face realities, and this is what is so abundantly necessary in our time. For if it is not to descend into oblivion, our age must learn to understand one thing especially. It must learn to understand the principle of the creative mind. It must learn to understand the significance of the fact that when the mind is engaged in a creative process, it is working with the same forces as live in the instincts. Except that whereas our instincts work in the darkness, the mind that has become creative works in the light of the sun, that is to say, of the spiritual sun. This is what our age needs to understand, and there is much in our time that is actively engaged in directly opposing this. Cato, the Roman statesman, whose main policy was to establish a strong framework for the Roman state, regarded it as a necessary precondition for the achievement of this purpose to exile those who were engaged in Greek or Hellenistic philosophy, for, he said, quote, they only chatter, and this undermines the decrees of our authority, close quote. Machiavelli, the great Renaissance figure from Florence, agreed with this and especially praised Cato for banishing those who interfered with government decrees from the standpoint of spiritual knowledge. Machiavelli also fully appreciated the fact that in Rome the death penalty was at certain times used as a tool to make people submissive to the social order. Having anything to do with the spiritual world was something utterly abhorrent to Rome and to its successors in Europe. Efforts were therefore made in a great number of areas to create as much uncertainty as possible regarding such matters and to cover them with a veil of secrecy. It is nevertheless the case that if a conception of the mystery of Golgotha, that is, of the fully uncompromising nature that such a conception really needs to have, makes its presence felt in the world, these mists of uncertainty and unawareness will evaporate, rather as snow in sunlight. This has thoroughly uncomfortable consequences. But it must happen. And what needs to happen most of all is to arrive at a true understanding of the being of Christ. In the next lecture, I shall discuss how the human soul can directly approach the Christ being in our time. However, much can be gained in this respect if we focus our attention, on the one hand, on a figure who, I would say, inaugurated the exoteric aspect of Western cultural development, and on the other hand, on the figure of Julian the Apostate, who tried, in a way that proved impossible at the time, to take up the struggle against this exoteric aspect of Western evolution. But what is curious about all of this is that if someone today with only a little knowledge, I am not even saying a little knowledge of occult facts, but merely a little knowledge of such facts as is still contained in certain ancient writings, makes a study of Christian dogma, some remarkable things emerge. And if such a person considers something like the Mass, again, not with occult knowledge, but with the insights recorded in ancient writings that derived originally from these occult sources, some equally surprising results arise from such a study, as they do in the case of dogma. One then begins to ask oneself, what lies behind this dogma and these cultic rituals? Not only I, but countless writers who have studied these questions from the standpoint referred to have come to the conclusion that in both dogma and ritual, there is such an enormous amount of ancient paganism present in a revived or reconstituted form that one can make the attempt, like, for example, the French writer Drach, who was well familiar with ancient Hebrew, to demonstrate that everything in the dogmas and rituals of the Catholic Church is simply a revival of paganism. And other authors have attempted to show that certain people went to great lengths to hide this fact, so that it should not become generally known that the dogmas and rituals of the Church are imbued with paganism. It would be a strange phenomenon if paganism were indeed to be living on in this very unconscious way. And the question might well arise, what would the survival of paganism have contributed to the survival of the Imperium Romanum? And how would things stand then with Julian the Apostate? Indeed, if many ancient writers are correct in saying that, for example, the Catholic Mass is to all intents and purposes an ancient pagan sacrifice, and Julian expended all his energy on preventing the decline of ancient pagan customs and trying to perpetuate them, he did, to a certain extent, achieve something after all. Innumerable, highly intractable problems, as Nietzsche says, problems with horns, arise from a study of the great contrast between Julian the Apostate and Constantine. problems of this nature, which are fraught with fateful consequences for us today, urgently need to become the issues of our time. I shall take up this theme again next time. The end of Lecture 14.